أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. So the translation goes as, in the name of Allah, the most merciful, the most compassionate. Praise be to Allah, the Lord of the universe, the most merciful, the most compassionate, the master of the day of recompense. You alone do we worship, and you alone do we turn to for help. Direct us on the straight path, the way of those whom you have favored, who did not incur your wrath, and who are not astray. Thank you.
Thank you for that beautiful recitation. I'd like to thank everyone for coming out tonight. As part of our Islamic Appreciation Week, we have Suzy Ismail here. We'll be discussing what Western understandings of Muslim womanhood have come to entail. Her talk will unpack negative stereotypes and portrayals of Muslim women as they exist in our society. Suzy Ismail is the founder and head communication counselor at Cornerstone, a faith-based communication counseling center that focuses on identity building and improving relationships for couples, families, and youth. She is the author of several books, including Modern Muslim Marriage, 9 to 5, When Muslim Marriage Fails, and several others. She specializes in presenting a range of communication lectures and diversity workshops at major corporations, universities, and events. She has been interviewed on numerous media outlets and is often featured on international talk shows and radio and television broadcasts regarding the subject of her work. Suzy provides youth, marriage, and women empowerment, gender relations, identity, and family seminars locally and globally, and is a student advisor at a private high school. She currently serves as an executive officer and director on several nonprofit boards, commissions, and organizations. She is completing her doctorate in human services with a focus on family intervention and resides in Princeton, New Jersey with a husband and 3 kids. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Suzy Ismail. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay, and now we can hear it. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. I greet you with the message of peace and blessings that is traditionally the greeting used by Muslims. When we think of the topic of women in Islam, or when we use the terms Muslim women, what comes to mind? For many of us, the first thing that comes to mind is the idea of oppression, or the idea of powerlessness or vulnerability. We often think of gender discrimination, of female genital mutilation, of elements that are thrown at us through the media, through movies, through lenses that do not accurately portray what it means to be a Muslim woman, or what Islam, the faith, says about women. All of these things that I spoke about, that I mentioned in that first statement, do happen. But they happen not because of Islam. They happen in spite of Islam. So why do we dedicate a day in the week of Islamic Awareness Week to women in Islam? Why not a day or an evening discussing men in Islam? Why, when we look at our college curriculums or course offerings, do we see so many classes about women? Women in Islam, women in Judaism, women in America today, women's studies. Why this focus and fascination with women? Why is March considered Women's History Month?
a month in which women are celebrated, a month in which women are discussed, a month in which women are really looked into in terms of their history, their stance in society, what their gender means, and who they are. The reason why there is this fascination with women, whether it be women in Islam or women of any other faith, any other culture, race, background, heritage, is because the truth is that every 15 seconds, a girl or a woman somewhere in the world is sexually assaulted, abused, or raped. More than a third of all women worldwide, that's 35.6%, will experience physical or sexual violence in their lifetime. And that's according to the World Health Organization. Women perform 66% of the world's work and produce 50% of its food, but earn only 10% of its income and 1% of its property. Every year, 60 million girls are assaulted on their way to school. And in fact, in some parts of the world, a girl is more likely to be raped than to go to school. And this has nothing to do with Islam, with Christianity, with Judaism. It doesn't have anything to do with faith of any type, but it does have to do with a system of oppression. It does have to do with societies that try to hold down a large percentage of this population. Why? You know, a few years back, there was a gentleman by the name of Greg Mortensen who traveled to the mountains of Afghanistan and Pakistan. He was a mountain climber. And while he was climbing the mountains there, he fell and got hurt. And there was a family in Afghanistan that took him in. And they drank with him 3 cups of tea. And after drinking the 3 cups of tea with him, they told him, "Now you are like family." And he was so taken by the hospitality of this family that he vowed that if he ever came back to the United States, he would create an organization. And with that organization, he would raise funds to build schools in these countries. And so true to his words, he came back to the US and he created an organization called Pennies for Peace. And he went back to Afghanistan and Pakistan and began to build schools. But all the schools that he built there were schools for girls. And when he was being interviewed by some journalists about this project, about this journey that he had begun, they asked him, "Why are you only building schools for girls? Isn't it important to educate boys as well?" And he responded and said, "If I educate a boy, I have educated an individual. If I educate a girl, I have educated a generation." And we see that the importance or the value placed on women, regardless which society they are in, has been something that historically has been both elevated and also seen as a threat. So where does this play into the situation of Islam? In order to understand the view of women in Islam, we first have to look at the pre-Islamic view of women in the Jahiliyya, or in the period in Arabia prior to the advent of Islam. And we see in that period of time, as in much of the rest of the world as well, women were not valued. Women were viewed as a commodity. Women were viewed as items to be bartered, whether it was through marriage or through birth. They were seen as an object rather than as individuals. One of the first injunctions that came down in the form of a ruling in the Quran, one of the first revelations that prohibited something of the Jahiliyyah period, was the prohibition of female infanticide. And in the Quran, there is a verse that states, وَإِذَا الْمَوْءُودَةُ سُئِلَتْ بِأَيِّ ذَنْبٍ قُتِلَتْ. And when the infant child, the female infant that is buried alive, asks for what reason was she killed? And the verse continues by explaining that there is great punishment for the one that kills an infant child for her gender. And female infanticide was one of the very first elements of the Jahiliyya that was banned in Islam. So we see that the status of women became a point in Islam that was central in the faith, that women themselves began to realize that they had value, that they were individuals, that they had rights, that they would be judged by God on the merit of their deeds and not based on their gender. And we see that the movement in terms of the value of women from the societal perspective to a religious perspective came in the way that the women that surrounded the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, were treated. We see that the first wife of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, was Khadija. May God be pleased with her. And we recognize the importance of this female and her role as being the first female who accepted Islam, the first person that accepted Islam. She was a widow who, when the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, came into her life in the form of working for her business, she was a widow who had inherited from her father a very well-to-do trading business. And the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, before receiving the revelation, was known in his community as Al-Amin, the trustworthy. And so she hired this gentleman who was known as a trustworthy one because he was recommended highly by many people. And although she was many years his senior, she would hear about his character. Her servants would come back and tell her that on their travels they had never seen a man that was so trustworthy, a man that was so kind, a man that did so much in terms of ensuring the well-being of others around him. And when she would listen to this, she felt confident that these were the characteristics she was looking for in a spouse. And so she sent her relative to speak to him about the possibility of marriage. And they had a beautiful monogamous marriage for many years. And the relationship between the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, and Khadija was one that was incredibly interesting because it was built upon mutual respect. There's a woman by the name of Karen Armstrong who wrote a book called The History of God. And in it, she describes the origins of the three monotheistic religions. And she speaks of Islam and says that Islam is the only religion that was born in the lap of a woman. And when her book first came out, many Muslims around the world were kind of like, what does she mean by that? Why would she say that? And then in an interview following the publication of her book, she explained what she meant by that line. And she said, I was so taken by the fact that when the Prophet received the revelation, the very first person that he went to speak to about it was his wife. And it was in his wife's lap when he said, cover me, cover me, as he shivered and relayed the information of what he had just seen, that his wife was the one that stood next to him and told him, you are good to your neighbors, you are kind to your family, surely our Lord will never forsake you. And it was his wife who stood beside him, emotionally, spiritually, physically, financially, encouraging and supporting him. And so we see that one of the firm role models in Islam, one of the women in Islam that Muslim women look up to, is a woman who was strong, a woman who was independent, a woman who owned her own wealth, a woman who was respected by her husband and had that mutual respect. And we see that as an example of what a strong woman in Islam looks like. And the interesting thing is that when we look at the many women in Islamic history, we see this thread of strength, of decision-making, of having a voice streaming through all of the women in Islamic history. And the women who are revered even in the pre-Islamic era also highlight these elements. One of the most revered women in Islam who has a chapter dedicated to her in the Quran is Maryam, which is known in Catholicism and Christianity as the Virgin Mary. Maryam is revered in Islam as a woman who obeyed the commandment of God, but who was also strong and decisive and could stand up for herself. In the Quran, there is a chapter in the Quran known as Ali Imran, in which the mother of Maryam and her situation is described, and the birth of Maryam is described. And in that chapter, we are told that when Maryam was born, her mother, who had been so grateful to be expecting a child, had made a pledge to God. And she said, I dedicate what is in my womb to the service of God. And when she gave birth to Maryam, she turned to God again and she said, I have given birth to a female and not a male. And the female is not like the male, but I stand by my pledge to dedicate her to your service. And so we know that at that period of time in history, women were not expected to spend time in the temple studying monotheism or becoming well-versed in theology. And yet the mother of Maryam had already dedicated her to that service. And in that chapter in the Quran, we are told that God accepted her onto his service. And so she was raised in the temple in an area known as al-mihrab, which is the highest station in the temple, which was traditionally reserved for male scholars. And she was raised there by her uncle, kafalaha Zakariya, which means Zakariya, that her uncle, who was also a prophet, is the one who raised her. He would check on her, make sure she was okay. And we are told in the Quran that her uncle would enter upon her, and he would see the fruits of summer and winter time, and the fruits of winter and summertime. And he would ask her, where is this from? And Maryam would respond and say, surely this is from my Lord. He says, be and it can be. Kun fayakun. And so we see that there is this faith that is emanating from a woman who is revered in Islam. And we see that when she comes upon a situation where she is commanded by God, told by God that she will bear a child, even though she has not been touched by anyone, and she is commanded by God to go back to her people with this child, she follows that commandment of God, despite any fear or hesitation she might have. And when she goes back to her people, and prior to going back to her people, when she gives birth to the child, she's commanded by God to shake the trunk of the palm tree. And again, in this moment, we know that a woman who has given birth to a child alone in a desert, if she were to shake the trunk of a palm tree, no fruit would really fall, because a palm tree is very difficult to shake. And if you've ever tried to shake a palm tree, you know it doesn't shake easily. And yet she shakes the trunk of the palm tree and the fruit falls. And in that moment, again, we are shown that here is a situation where a woman is commanded by God to take action. That God is the one that will say, be and it will be, but she takes action. And the fruit falls and she continues on her path. We see this similar situation in Hajar, the mother of Ismail, who was the wife of Ibrahim, the prophet also. And Abraham is, of course, the father of the monotheistic faiths. And we see that when he received a revelation, a commandment, to bring his wife and his child into the desert, Hajar, as she walked behind Prophet Ibrahim, continued to ask, why are you leaving us in the desert? And at first he didn't answer. And she asked again, why are you leaving us in the desert? And again, he didn't answer. And a third time, why are you leaving us in the desert? And when she repeated after that, is this a commandment from your Lord? And Abraham answered, yes, it is. Her response was that surely our Lord will protect us. Again, she recognized that if this is a commandment from God, there would be protection. And yet when she went into the desert with the infant, Ismail, and he began to cry, she didn't just sit beside the infant and say, our Lord will protect us, I'll just wait for that protection to come. She went 7 times back and forth between 2 mountains, Safa and Marwa, looking for water, knowing that God would protect her, but also taking action. Another example of a woman who recognized that there is a commandment from God and was in full confidence, sure that God would protect her and the child, but still took action. So why are these women in our history of our faith important? What do we learn from them? We learn the importance of being able to take that action. We learn the importance of having that faith in God, committing to the commandments of God, but also committing to actions on our part. In the Quran, we see a verse in Surah Al-Ahzab, the chapter of Al-Ahzab, that talks about men and women. And it phrases the importance of men and the importance of women by saying, indeed, the Muslim men and the Muslim women, the believing men and the believing women, the men who do good deeds and the women who do good deeds. And the verse continues by delineating the deeds of men and the deeds of women. And in the end of the verse, there is a promise that unto all who do good, there is great reward. And in that verse, there is a capturing of the equality between men and women in the eyes of God, in Islam. That man or woman, you will be judged based on the merit of your deeds, based on your actions, not based on your gender. Now, any conversation about women in Islam is of course not complete without addressing something that comes up frequently in conversation, something that comes up frequently in topics that discuss women in Islam. Whenever I'm invited to speak on the topic of Islam or women in Islam, frequently the titles of the talks will be something like Lifting the Veil, Understanding Women in Islam, or Behind the Veil, Women in Islam, or Hidden Beneath the Veil, Women in Islam. And there seems to be this fascination with the unveiling or the removing of the veil for women in Islam. Now, the reality is that we as human beings are naturally inclined to judge by the visual. We as human beings are naturally inclined to process information first with our eyes and then transmit the translation of that information to our minds. And then our judgments are formed. And so for many Muslim women around the world, the very first thing that is seen is the veil or the covering. Whether it is worn as hijab, which is the traditional form of the name, which is seen most frequently, where everything is covered except for the face or the hands, or niqab, which is considered in many places the black covering of the face, the face veil, where everything is covered except for the eyes. Or the burqa, which we see in other areas of the Middle East, in which everything is covered either in brown or blue, with even netting over the eyes. But whatever variation it is in, or whatever form it's in, the clothing of the Muslim woman has become a topic of conversation around the world. Recently, there was quite a bit of a stir in many European countries where the hijab was banned in public places and in federal buildings. In other places, in schools, there are questions about whether or not hijab can be worn. If you've ever traveled on any flight wearing hijab, you know that that's always cause for a little extra TSA love and care. And we see that the hijab has become the symbol of what it means to be a Muslim woman. But what is the hijab exactly, and how do we understand it in Islam? And what does it mean for the Muslim woman? Every faith has a central characteristic. And the central characteristic of Islam, as described by the Prophet, is haya, which means modesty. So modesty is an integral part of the faith of Islam. Not just modesty in dress, but modesty in action, modesty in the way we speak, modesty in the way that we interact. And that modesty, as we explained in the verse from Surah Al-Ahzab earlier, that modesty is part of the believing in God and answering the commandments of God. It's part of that committing to the good deeds that bring one closer to God. When we look at the verses in the Quran in the chapter known as Surah An-Nur, the chapter of light, we see the commandment of modesty coming up in two verses. Now, what's interesting is that verse 30 is the first commandment of modesty. And it's a commandment of modesty towards men. Tell the believing men to be modest. And it describes the modesty of men, the lowering of the gaze, the modesty in terms of their interactions. And the verse that follows, verse 31, is a commandment of modesty to women. And it commands women to be modest, and it describes the form of modesty to women. And in that verse, women are commanded to pull their coverings upon their chests. Now, what's interesting in this description, in this verse of the Quran, is that even within the Muslim community, sometimes there's discussion about, well, what does that mean? If it says draw the covering around the chest, then doesn't that mean that the hair doesn't need to be covered? But when we look at the verses in the Quran, we understand them in context as well as in content. And so we see that prior to the advent of Islam, women traditionally, women of honor or women of station, traditionally threw a veil over their heads. But the veil was often translucent and it was left open in the chest area. And if we visit any Catholic church, if we visit, look at paintings, for example, even of the Virgin Mary, we'll see that in the paintings there was always a translucent veil thrown over her hair with the chest exposed. And so we see that prior to Islam, women of station, women of honor, women of wealth would exit their homes wearing this veil. But if a woman who was considered a slave or of lower station tried to exit her home with a veil on her head, she would be beaten. because it was considered something that was reserved for the women of honor. When the verses in the Quran commanding of modesty were revealed, they simply stated that that head covering must be pulled to cover the chest as well. And we don't understand the Quran in a vacuum. It's not just the Quran that guides us. So for example, the Quran commands Muslims to pray, but nowhere in the Quran does it explain the exact way to pray. Nowhere in the Quran does it say the five times a day. Where do we learn it from? From the Sunnah, or the practices of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. And so we see from the Sunnah of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, a further explanation of what the hijab for the woman is, of what the covering entails. And we see that that covering is that form of modesty for women, but above and beyond that, it is an answer to the commandment of God. It is an answer to the commandment of God in how a woman carries her modesty, just as men carry their modesty in a different way. And so today, sometimes we will hear the question as, well, I have this Muslim friend and she doesn't wear hijab. Does that make her not Muslim? Or I know so-and-so and this person doesn't wear hijab. You know, why does the hijab have to define what it means to be a Muslim? The hijab doesn't define whether a person is Muslim or not Muslim. The hijab is simply another act of obedience to God. It's another commitment to God, another answer to one of his commandments. And although, you know, we were having this conversation earlier with some of the young women upstairs, although externally we are creatures who judge with our eyes, we may see a young woman who wears hijab and we say, oh, that's a Muslim right there. We may not know what goes on in the life of that young woman, the part we don't see. That woman may not struggle with wearing the hijab. It may come easy for her to put on the hijab, but she may struggle with praying her five prayers on time. She may struggle with being modest in her gaze at home. She may struggle with being respectful to her parents. She may struggle with fasting during Ramadan. Just because we don't see that struggle doesn't mean that struggle isn't there. And yet there are also Muslim women who may do wonderfully well in terms of keeping to their prayers, who may fast in Ramadan and it may come very easy to them. And yet it may be a struggle for them to wear the hijab. They may find that difficult. That doesn't make one person less Muslim than the other. It just means there's a difference in our struggles. And that, yes, we believe that the commandments of God are clear to us, but sometimes it's harder to commit to one commandment as opposed to another. And in that way, as women, sometimes we can be our own worst enemies. Because as women, sometimes we find ourselves being the most judgmental. We find ourselves being the ones who reach out or try to hold one another to a near impossible standard. Now, when we look at women today, Muslim women in particular, we see a situation where many of us are caught in a bit of a conundrum. You know, the feminist Gloria Steinem, although I don't agree with a lot of what she says, there was a statement that she made once that I thought made a lot of sense. She said, in trying to find the perfect men to marry, we have become those perfect men. And she was speaking about women in general. But the reality is that we've entered an era and a period of time in our society where women feel that they need to choose. They can either have a career, be highly educated, seek out that master's, that PhD, or be married, have children, raise a family. And that either or is something that society has created. It's not something that's rooted in faith. It's not something that's rooted in Islam and Christianity and Judaism. But it's a dichotomy that has been created, and it's from a very, very long time ago. We see that among the earliest works when the feminist dialogue began to appear, there was conversations trying to answer the question of who am I as a woman? Can I be a woman who has a family, raises children, but who also has a career, who is also educated? And we begin to see the openings of these dialogues in literature such as Ibsen's A Doll's House or Kate Chopin's The Awakening. And we see that the conversation continued until about the 1950s, 1960s, with the advent of a book called The Feminine Mystique by a woman by the name of Betty Friedan. And in her book, She began to ask that question, what does it mean to be a woman today? Can a woman have a career, have an education, but also be successful at home? And she left the question unanswered, but it was considered a groundbreaking work that began to ask that question. But if we fast forward now to today, just a few short years ago, the news and the media was in an uproar when Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, made some statements at a commencement ceremony. And in that commencement ceremony, she stood in front of audience. It was actually at Barnard College, an all-women's college. And in her commencement ceremony, she spoke to these women and she said, you may think that the most important decision you make will be what job you land after this commencement ceremony, or you know what graduate program you go to, or what you do in terms of your career. But I'm here to tell you that the most important decision you will make is who you marry. Now, when she made this statement, the young women in the audience were up in arms. They were very upset at her. They were like, how could you say that? You know, we're not going to get married. We don't need another person in our life. And it was a huge situation. In response to that reaction, Sheryl Sandberg wrote a book called Lean In. And in that book, Lean In, she tried to explain the importance of the dynamic of the family and why women have been set up and placed in a situation where they feel forced to choose either or. And in the end, she ends her book with a question. What does it mean to be a woman today? What is the role of the woman? Can a woman occupy both spaces simultaneously? Now, unfortunately, a few years after the publication of this book, Sheryl Sandberg's husband passed away, suddenly and unexpectedly. And she's written several essays and pieces of writing after his passing. And she spoke again about the situation that women have to face. Can there be that balance? Or is it either or? Now, when we look at women in Islam and we understand the notion of what it means to be a married woman in Islam, we see that the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, in his last khutbah, his last sermon to his ummah, to his people, made a statement. And in it, he spoke to the men, and he reminded the men that just as you have rights over your wives, they have rights over you. And he continued by saying, they are your committed partners and helpers. And he advised the men of his ummah to be kind to their wives. And when we look at that terminology, committed partners and helpers, we see that this is the definition of what gender equality looks like. This is what it means to have a relationship, to have a situation and a community and a society that is built upon a foundation where husband and wife work together, where there is a partnership between two people, where both men and women know that they are equal in the eyes of God and they are judged based on the merits of their deeds, that they are judged based on their actions, not on their gender. And this is something that unfortunately, whether it's cultures or governments or societies making decisions, is sometimes muddled and is sometimes hidden underneath lines and theories and ideas that are antithetical to what Islam really says about women. Now, a few years ago, there was a woman by the name of Tawakkul Karmin who led many of the peaceful protests in Yemen. And during the Arab Spring, it was right before the Arab Spring had really kind of taken over. Of course, now we know it turned into the Arab Fall. It didn't get as far as we would have hoped. But during that time, she had led many of the peaceful protests. And she was interviewed by some journalists after that. And the journalists were commenting on the way that she was dressed. She was wearing the traditional hijab. And they spoke to her and they said, don't you think this is, you know, a little bit backwards? You've just won the Nobel Peace Prize. You've just led an entire region into essentially changing their governments and their history. Don't you think it's time to be more modern? And her response was very beautiful. She said, man in the early times was almost naked. And as his intellect evolved, he started wearing clothes. What I am today and what I'm wearing represents the highest level of thought and civilization that man has achieved. And it's not regressive. It's the removal of clothing again that is regressive back to ancient times. And it's incredibly interesting when we view the dress of a woman as something that belongs to her, as something that shows her commitment in terms of faith, as something that shows her way of answering a commandment of God. Now, it's interesting because, as I mentioned, in the Muslim community, many times we'll also have talks about Muslim dress and hijab. And many times, you know, in these talks, we'll have well-meaning lecturers, many times male lecturers, who will speak about hijab. And they might say things like, you know, the Muslim woman is like a pearl, and the pearl is in the oyster, and the oyster is in the bottom of the ocean. And this is why Muslim woman wears hijab. Or the Muslim woman is like the flower, and she can only bloom in front of her husband, and this is why a woman wears hijab. Or most recently, there was a conversation about candy, that if you had two lollipops, one has a wrapper on it or a cover, and one doesn't have a cover, and you throw them both on the ground, and you pick them both up, which one would you like to eat? The one that has the wrapper or the one that doesn't have the wrapper? And then the response is, oh, of course, the one that has the wrapper. And this is why Muslim women wear hijab. Now, a few years ago, I was giving a talk to a largely Muslim audience. And so I talked about a kiwi. And I said, imagine you had two kiwis. And one kiwi had the covering on it, the hair on it. And the other one didn't. And you take both kiwis and you throw them on the ground and you lift them up. Which one would you want to eat? And everyone said, oh, the one that's still covered, the one that still has the hair. And I said, and this is why Muslim men have beards. Shaking their head, oh no, sister, you got that wrong. It's not mine. And when you look at the rationale in that way, you begin to realize that when we try to put human definitions or human analogies on something that is not meant to be captured in that way, we go wrong. Because the hijab is not the covering on a lollipop. The hijab is not the oyster shell and a pearl. The hijab is simply a piece of clothing. It is a covering, but it's an answer to a commandment of God. It's a way of worshiping God. It's a reminder for the woman to remember that this is something that God has commanded you. It is not something that holds the woman back. It is not something that means the woman cannot have a voice, cannot speak up. When we look at Aisha, one of the wives of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, we see that she became the foremost narrator of hadith, the transmitter of hadith after the death of the Prophet. She would teach the Sahaba, the companions. She had a voice. When we look at Hafsa, the daughter of Umar, one of the khalifas, one of the caliphs, she was very outspoken and she had a lot to say. One of my favorite narrations that I often share when speaking about the topic of marriage is there came a time when Umar, who was a companion of the Prophet, and after one of the khalifas, one of the caliphs after the death of the Prophet, he was in his home with his wife. And his wife was really giving him a piece of her mind, you know, saying, oh, I don't like this, and I'm upset about this, and things like that. And as he was speaking with his wife, someone from the community came to his door, and he raised his hand up to knock on the door. And he heard voices, and then he put his hand down and started to walk away. So Umar exited his home and asked the man, he said, you came to speak to me about something. Why didn't you come in? Why are you leaving? And so the man said, I came to complain to you about my wife. And he said, but I see that you have your own problem, so I decided to leave. So Umar stopped the man, and he said to him, you know, this is the woman who cares for me. This is the woman who raises my children. This is the woman who protects me from fitna. This is the woman who cares for my home. Should I not listen to her grievances when she wants to share them with me? And so we see that that voice is something that's important, whether it's internally in a relationship text or externally in terms of teaching. One of the greatest women role models in Islam is Fatima, the daughter of the Rasul, the daughter of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. And we see that Fatima had the nickname from her youth of Umma Abiha, which means the mother of her father, because she was very kind and caring to her father, but she also took on a great deal of responsibility in terms of looking out for her father. And the respect was reciprocal. When the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, would enter a room, he would see Fatima even as a child, and he would lift her up and kiss her on the forehead. When he'd be seated in a room and Fatima would enter, he would lift himself up, he would remove himself from the chair and ask Fatima to sit in his place. When Fatima was just a child, around the age of 11 or 12 years old, she stood in the doorway of the home. and she saw the prophet, her beloved father, praying on a hilltop. And she saw the disbelievers, the enemies of Islam, surround the prophet as he was praying. And the disbelievers reached into the inside of a dead camel that was nearby and pulled out the guts and the filth from the dead camel and began to throw it upon the back of her father as he prostrated in prayer. Now Fatima, even as a young 11 or 12-year-old girl, left the home in that moment and parted her way between those who surrounded her father and began to remove the filth from the back of her father as tears streamed down her face. And she sat beside her father as he finished his prayer. When he finished his prayer, he turned to his daughter. And he didn't say to her, "Why are you out here? This is no place for a young woman." He didn't say to her, "Go back to the home, you don't belong here." He wiped her tears and he kissed her forehead. And he said, "Do not be sad, for surely your Lord will allow your father to be victorious." And so we see that even as a young girl, there was an elevation in terms of respect. There was a treatment of young women as individuals, as people who had a voice, as people who had rights, as people who deserve a place in society. And that's what it means to be a Muslim woman today. That's what it meant to be a Muslim woman back then. To have a voice, to have rights, to be seen in the eyes of God as an equal based on your deeds, on your merits, as an equal to a male based on his deeds and his merits as well. And this is what we've lost, unfortunately, in societies that have corrupted what it means to be a Muslim woman, in governments that have feared the education of a generation, in governments that have suppressed the education of women because of that fear of what it might mean for generations to come. So I know we want to have time for question and answer, so I'm going to wrap up at this point and then turn the floor to question and answer, if that's okay. Thank you so much. Assalamualaikum.
Thank you for that amazing talk. I hope you all enjoyed it as much as I did. I learned a lot. So if does anyone else have any questions specific? Go ahead. If you want to stand up, you can stand up too.
It's okay, as long as you saw me. thank you, sister, for that lovely talk. It was really inspiring, not just as a cliche, but really. And you touched on this already. You said that, like, you know, when people give so many analogies about the hijab and why we wear it, but, like, to Muslim people who don't know what, you know, a commandment of God is, just like prayer or fasting, like in a 1 minute talk or a 2 minute walk, like when they ask you, why do you wear the hijab, what do you tell them?
I think that's a great question, and I think it's a very telling question, because what often happens is that many people outside of the Muslim faith will feel that the hardest thing to do is to explain hijab to a non-Muslim. But the reality is, within our Muslim community, it can be a topic that's almost sensitive at times, because there are many Muslim women who may struggle with wearing the hijab, but not just struggle with it, also question whether or not this is a part of the faith. And unequivocally, with all the scholars that review the Qur'an, that have assessed the Qur'an, that have analyzed it, that verse in the Qur'an is not just the standalone that speaks about the modesty of the woman. The sunnah of the Rasul, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, learning from his actions, learning from the companions around him, also guides us. But in a 1 minute explanation, when you're speaking to someone about how is the hijab a commandment of God, again, we refer to the verse in the Quran in Surah An-Nur, that historical perspective of the veil was traditionally there. So that pulling the veil or pulling the head covering around the chest is simply an extension of something that had traditionally been in context there, but took it to the point where it covered more. And so it's a commandment from God in the Quran, it's a commandment in the Sunnah, it's a commandment that's very clear throughout the faith. And I think sometimes when we struggle with something, we may try to justify that, well, maybe it's not really something that I have to do, maybe it's not really part of the faith. And that's, there's going to be times where you have to say Allahu A'lam, which means God knows best. And there, it's okay for us to sometimes say that, to explain things within the best of our ability, and to sometimes say that God knows best. Because as I mentioned in my talk, sometimes as women, we are our own worst enemies. And we can go into that place of, you know, we talk about body shaming quite frequently today in our society, but in the Muslim community, there's also a lot of clothes shaming that goes on, you know, whether, you know, you're wearing hijab or not, if you're wearing skinny jeans with your hijab, if you've got lipstick on, you've got your hijab on, if you're wearing, you know, turban style, if you're posing for Playboy magazine and you wear hijab, if you, you know, there's a lot of topics that come up in conversation about what works and what doesn't work, and then what defines hijab and what doesn't define hijab. I think when we go back to the core of what is hijab and why is it mandated, again, it's the central theme of our faith. It is modesty. And anything that pulls us away from that central theme of modesty becomes something that is questionable. And anything that draws us closer to the central element of modesty is something that's pleasing to God.
Any other questions? Comments.
Did anyone do the hijab for a day? Does anyone want to share their thoughts or
is anyone here that's participating in hijab already that would like to?
Yeah.
No,
I mean I can talk.
Yeah, sure.
Yay.
Go
so
ahead.
I decided to do hijab for a day and thank you so much for talking. It was really wonderful talk. And I really didn't know what to expect. Honestly when I woke up this morning I was kind of like, I don't know how this is gonna go, I don't know what people are gonna think. But throughout the entire day, I've not received any negative comments. I've not received anything but appreciation from a lot of people, a lot of Muslims that are here, and a lot of non-Muslims as well. And I found it just a very eye-opening experience. There would be just some random comments from people like, oh, I think your hijab looks wonderful. One comment that I got from my friend who's been wearing it all week was, your hijab is actually a wedding hijab. So it was
you make mistakes a little bit.
And I know that I had one of my Muslims, who's a student in my group. And he's a fellow student in my class. And he walked up to me and he's like, oh, wait, oh, no, you're Rachel. Okay, cool. He thought I was another Muslim student. And he just like, I didn't know who you were. I thought you were a new student. I was like, who are you? And I just thought it was a very eye-opening experience. And I couldn't have chosen to, or I wouldn't have not chosen to do it. It's been a very eye-opening experience just learning about Islam in general as well. I've taken two classes on it this year. And it's a wonderful religion and I've never experienced this sort of this.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to share?
Okay, well, thank you all for coming tonight. Just a little plug, on Saturday there is a Women's Day conference put on by Loyola and a lot of different organizations, and you can, I think it's going to be around in the afternoon, noonish. Maybe like 1 o'clock, where we're going to continue this conversation. It's not just going to be about the veil, the hijab, or it's just going to be like about women in general. But we will continue this aspect of conversation as well. So if you guys are available, we would love for you guys to come out and, yeah. And also, tomorrow as part of Islam Appreciation Week, we will be having BAB lunch service event, which will be in the CFSU lobby. From 11 to 3 p.m. And at 5:30 we will meet in front of we will be in the lobby and head out at around 5:30 p.m. and we will distribute the lunches in downtown. That is all. Thank you all for coming.